जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी गोपी जना वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी यशोदानंदन ब्रज जन रंजन यमुना तीरावन चारी यमुना तीरावन चारी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय ओम विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राजकाचार्य अष्टोत्तर शत श्री श्रीमद हिज डिवाइन ग्रेस इसी भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी श्रील प्रभुपाद की जय अनंत कोटि वैष्णव वृंद की जय ग्रंथराज श्रीमद भागवतम की जय ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द असेंबल डिवोटीज ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द असेंबल डिवोटीज ऑल ग्लोरीज टू श्री श्री गुरु एंड गौरंग ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Granth Bhagavatam 8, the character of Bharat Maharaj, text number, 21, thank you, 21. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Alas, the small deer, while playing with me and seeing me feigning meditation with closed eyes, would circumambulate me due to anger arising from love, and it would fearfully touch me with the points of its soft horns, which felt like drops of water. Purport. Now King Bharata considers his meditation false. While engaged in meditation, he was actually thinking of his deer, and he would feel great pleasure when the animal pricked him with the points of its horns. Feigning meditation, the king would actually think of the animal, and this was but a sign of his downfall. We'll do a few verses. When I placed all the sacrificial ingredients on the kusha grass, the deer, when playing, would touch the grass with its teeth and thus pollute it. When I chastised the deer by pushing it away, it would immediately become fearful and sit down motionless, exactly like the son of a saintly person. Thus it would stop its play. Purport. Bharat Maharaj was constantly thinking of the activities of the deer, forgetting that such meditation and diversion of attention was killing his progress in spiritual achievement. Text 23 person. Thus it would stop its play. Purport. Bharat Maharaj was constantly thinking of the activities of the deer, forgetting that such meditation and diversion of attention was killing his progress in spiritual achievement. Text 23. After speaking like a madman in this way, Maharaj Bharat got up and went outside. Seeing the footprints of the deer on the ground, he praised the footprints out of love, saying, "O unfortunate Bharata, your austerities and penances are very insignificant compared to the penance and austerity undergone by this earth planet. Due to the earth's severe penances, the footprints of this deer, which are small, beautiful, most auspicious and soft, are imprinted on the surface of this fortunate planet. This series of footprints show a person like me who am bereaved due to loss of the deer, how the animal has passed through the forest, and how I can regain my lost wealth. By these footprints, this land has become a proper place for Brahmanas who desire heavenly planets or liberation to execute sacrifices to the demigods." Purport. It is said that when a person becomes gods. Purport. It is said that when a person becomes overly involved in loving affairs, he forgets himself as well as others, and he forgets how to act and how to speak. It is said that once when a man's son was blind since birth, the father, out of staunch affection for the child, named him Padmalochana, or lotus-eyed. This is the situation arising from blind love. Bharat Maharaj gradually fell into this condition due to his material love for the deer. It is said in the Smriti Shastra, "Yasmin deshe mrigah krishnas tasmin dharman ivodhata." The tract of land wherein the footprints of a black deer can be seen is to be understood as a suitable place to execute religious rituals. It is said in the Smriti Shastra, "Yasmin deshe mrigah krishnas tasmin dharman ivodhata." The tract of land wherein the footprints of a black deer can be seen is to be understood as a suitable place to execute religious rituals. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chaksur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Vishnam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swajaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare A symptom of advancement on the path of Krishna consciousness is that one is not under illusion, or one's illusion progressively decreases. The most pervasive illusion is to think of oneself as the body, or we call it the bodily conception of life. This bodily conception of life is not just restricted to thinking, "I am this body." It expands to all these things that are connected to my body belong to me. Aham mama iti. Janasya mohoyam. Moha, this bewilderment or illusion, is such that it forces a person to accept his body or her body as himself or herself, and also the expansions of the body as himself or herself, or as belonging to him or her. And unfortunately, it doesn't end there either. The illusion expands into seeing other things also that don't belong to him also as his own, or as an opportunity for his enjoyment. And although there is the concept of love, compassion, friendship, faith, fidelity, these are all still operating under the influence of illusion. And people become very, very strongly committed to things that are illusory, to relationships that are illusory. They become so committed to the cause of their nation, for example, or they become very committed to a particular ideology. And in fact, that passes as great quality within this universe, within the material realm. And that's why we see persons writing great poetry about his girlfriend. Or we'll find persons writing great songs of lamentation and sadness about a broken relationship with someone. Or they will write great poetry and write great literature about things of this world. It is still great within illusion. So what's the value of greatness within illusion? It's no value. The only difference is, it is said, does it matter if you are drowning? If, let's say, two persons are drowning, and one person is about 2 feet below the water, drowning, and another person is 20 feet below the water, but drowning. Can the person who's 2 feet below say, I'm in a better position than you are? No, both are drowning. So it's not like, I'm under illusion, but I'm better because I'm not so much under illusion. The only way where illusion begins to disperse or go away is in the presence of Krishna. Krishna Surya Sama, Maya Haya Andhakar. This illusion, by definition, means to accept something as reality when it is not. Maya. And the normal behavior, I guess, normal from a worldly perspective, is we accept everything that is not what it really is. We live in a world of illusion. We come up with dreams, aspirations that are also illusory. And every day, every moment, we accept things that are illusion as reality. Because this wrong conception of self is very deeply ingrained. The false ego has a very, very tight hold on the soul's consciousness. And actually the soul and false ego reside side by side, very, very, because both are very subtle. This is Krishna describing in the Bhagavad Gita. From gross to subtle, sense objects, senses, the mind, the intelligence, the false ego, and the soul. This is the gradation or hierarchy from gross to subtle. So this false ego has such strong influence on the soul. our own consciousness, that it renders the soul completely ineffective to doing anything that are activities connected to the soul. Like, for example, a Satchit Ananda, eternal, cognizant and fully blissful entity in the body of a hog, just looks for stool, grunts here and there and wallows in dirt. I mean, that is just so unbelievable, yet factual. Or the soul in a human body grunts a little, eats stool-like stuff, and wallows in dirt. It's just a different body, but pig-like behavior. No different. Or even in a so-called refined body with refined intelligence, university degree, still nothing to do with sat, chit, or ananda activities. This is what false ego does. It drags the soul from a very blissful state to a complete suffering condition. All because of misidentification. And although we may be experiencing as well, when we see in the lives of personalities like Bharat Maharaj, he's a very great person. I mean, he is a very great person. And the example is so stark that we can look at Bharat Maharaj and we might wonder, wow, really? You can become bewildered like that? There's one characteristic that is very important to understand, that our bewilderment is more obvious to others than to our own selves. And if it is not obvious, then that itself is an indicator that we are bewildered. Because a person who has knowledge can distinguish bewilderment from freedom from bewilderment. If we cannot distinguish, then that's an indicator, I'm bewildered. And if we are confused, am I bewildered or not? Then the safest assumption to make is the default condition, we are bewildered. Therefore, we need someone else to tell us. Therefore, we need someone else to help us identify where the bewilderment is and to what degree of intensity the bewilderment has covered us. So when we hear or read about Bharat Maharaj, and we read the way he's talking about a deer, I mean, it is really seems silly. He's calling the deer a prince. He's saying, when I'm meditating, I'm only feigning it. And when the deer would poke him with his horns, it felt so nice, like drops of water were caressing his skin. And he was waiting for the deer to come, goad him a little. And he's getting ready to perform a sacrificial yajna each morning, and the deer would come and eat the kusha grass, pick the kusha grass in his mouth, and he would lovingly chastise it. And when the deer would just sit down quietly as if upset or being chastised, like a child gets upset when you chastise the child, and then he would feel sorry for the deer. And his whole attention is on what the deer is doing. The whole concept of... Just few verses ago, we read how Bharat Maharaj had gotten far beyond all the rules and regulations. Going far beyond rules and regulations means that these rules and regulations become one's character, they're part of one's nature. Sadhana is a stage where these rules and regulations have to be practiced. One is very conscious, I'm supposed to follow this rule. When I come into the deity room, I'm supposed to offer my obeisances, for example. It's a rule that we have to be conscious about. how I cannot sit with my feet towards the deities, or something, I can't sit with my back to the deity. We have to be conscious. And practice brings perfection, or it brings about that particular habit to become second nature. That is called raganuga, spontaneity. So one doesn't have to remember, oh, I shouldn't sit with my back to the deity. One just doesn't sit that way. Because one is more aware, conscious, and habituated, if you will. I'm afraid to use the word habituated, because there's a difference between one's behavior arising from raganuga versus cultivating a habit. There's a little difference. Habit is something which comes outside in. Like if I were to practice writing with my left hand every day, maybe in some period of time, few months, I would be proficient in writing with my left hand. That's a habit. Bhakti is not a habit. Bhakti is the uncovering of the soul, so it's an inside-out process. But I'm using the word habituated to give an indication that how when we practice, these things become our nature. So by the time a person comes to bhava and prema stage, doesn't have to worry about these things. Am I following the proper rules? Oh, it's nothing like this. It's just one's nature. When Bharat Maharaj was there, now when the deer is chewing on his kusha grass, for him, it's a sweet exchange. Oh, Donna, it's just completely not okay to do like that. Because this sacrificial yajna means all the ingredients and paraphernalia are supposed to be pure and sanctified and kept that way and used that way. And part of the bewilderment, if you will, is that he is speaking truth and reality, but from a relative platform. So I'll give you an example. In the Smriti Shastra, Prabhupada is giving us this example. Yasmin deshe mrigaha krishnas, tasmin dharma nivodhata. That if you find the footprints of a black deer in a forest, that is an indicator that this is a sanctified and a nice place to execute religious duties. Because that indicates that the deer are not in any agitated condition. Deer get agitated because of the presence of ferocious animals. But if the deer's footprints are there, that's an indicator that they are peaceful. So you can perform religious activities there. So when he looks at the, now Bharat Maharaj, when he looks at the footprints of the deer, he does say, oh, how fortunate is Mother Earth for carrying the footprints of this deer. But he's speaking from a relative platform, although so supposedly truth, but from a relative platform. Truth spoken from a relative platform is not as effective as truth spoken from an absolute platform. There are many persons who can come and say, God is great. And when Prabhupada says, God is great, there's a big difference. And a pure devotee says, God is great, there's a whole different connotation to it. But both are speaking the truth in one sense. The relative person in the relative field will come and say, God is very great because he gave me a job. Or something, he removed my distress. Sometimes we get in our bhakti vrikshas some new persons who are beginning to appreciate Krishna consciousness. And we ask them any realization during the week. How did you feel the presence of Krishna or something like that? They would say, oh, I was working on a software problem and the problem was not getting solved. And I chanted Hare Krishna and suddenly the software code worked. So Krishna is like, basically he's doing your job and you're getting the salary. But it's not a wrong thing. But it's just from a relative perspective. That Krishna is providing me the intelligence. Yeah. But what's the real, from an absolute stance, what's the kind of intelligence Krishna provides? Yena mam upayantite. I give intelligence by which someone can come to me. I give intelligence by which one's devotional service is enhanced. Like that. So truth can be spoken from a relative platform, but it's not as effective. It doesn't have the full realization associated with that truth. So he's talking about, in his affection, and this is one thing about here Prabhupada says, it is said that when a person becomes overly involved in loving affairs, he forgets himself as well as others, and he forgets how to act and how to speak. This statement is valid in the material or relative field, and it is completely valid on the absolute field as well. On the relative plane, meaning on the material side of things, people who are overly involved in loving affairs, they call each other all sorts of names. And they forget where they are, what they are doing. It doesn't matter. What we call it in America, PDA, public display of affection. They forget where they are, what they are doing. They're so into each other. And they speak in some really funny ways. On the absolute realm, the loving affairs is with Krishna. And so those devotees whose full love, prema has been awakened, or bhava has been awakened, they also behave in ways that others cannot understand. They forget themselves. They will cry, they will laugh, roll on the floor. The body will tremble, tears will come out of their eyes like syringes. And words will come out in some incoherent way. Gadgad ruddhaya gira pulakair nichitam vapu kada tavanam grahane bhavishyati. This is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu describing that these are, when will those symptoms arise? When Lord Chaitanya would chant Hare Krishna, he met Ishwarapuri and he got initiation and he was asked to chant the Hare Krishna mantra, and as soon as he began chanting, all these ecstatic symptoms began showing up. So he was worried, what am I doing wrong? Something not okay, what's going on? So he went back to Ishwarapuri and said, please tell me, something's not okay. As soon as I chant, tears come out of my eyes, my body trembles, the hair stands on end. And Ishwarapuri said, very nice, continue chanting like this. These are proper symptoms to have. And when Lord Chaitanya would do so, others would not understand. Prakashananda Saraswati and his entourage did not associate with him. Said, oh, he's a madman. He's not performing his sannyas dharma properly. He only frivolously sings and chants and roams around the streets singing and dancing. We cannot associate with him. If he were to study Vedanta, then yeah, something we have in common. But what is the singing and dancing like a sentimentalist? And in extreme loving affairs situation, Lord Chaitanya, on one occasion, instead of calling out names of Krishna, was calling out the names of the gopis. And others thought, whoa, what is that? What is that? Why are you calling the names of gopis? In fact, his own students corrected him. This is not right. You should call the names of Krishna. That's when Lord Chaitanya took a stick and ran, chased the students away. But these are symptoms of loving affairs. One time in Vrindavan, Srila Prabhupada was speaking to his disciples, and as is common in Vrindavan, there are persons of varied spiritual tastes and behaviors. And one such person sauntered right into the temple area and started trembling like this, and words were coming out in like some stammer or stutter, and fainting and rolling on the ground. And the devotees were very fascinated. Oh wow, ecstatic symptoms in Vrindavan, Vraja something. And Prabhupada called one of the devotees and said, kick the person hard. So, whoa, yes, kick the person hard. So Prabhupada said so, and so when they kicked the person, the man cowered. Ah, Prabhupada said, see, this is all imitation. Real bhava is not existing. This is all a show. Just to gather other person's appreciation. This is a show. They describe it. But when Lord Chaitanya saw Lord Jagannath the first time, he fainted in ecstasy. And the gatekeepers, well, the doorkeepers of Lord Jagannath's altar, they also thought, oh, this is a show. And they were ready to beat up Lord Chaitanya. When Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya intervened and said, oh, let's first test. So he had a few fibers of cotton placed near the nostrils of Lord Chaitanya to see that there was no bodily activity going on, yet there was very subtle breathing. He said, oh, this is a specific state of ecstasy. So no, don't beat him up. Please bring him to my house. So there is madness in material love, which is real madness. And then there is madness in spiritual love, which is love. One is love, the other is madness. But the behaviors look very similar. So Krishna cautions us in the Bhagavad Gita, Ya nisha sarva bhutanam tasyam jagrati samyami. That the activities of a yogi and the activities of a bhogi sometimes look similar, but the differences of night and day. When the consciousness of the bhogi is all awake, the consciousness of the yogi is not excited. Because the bhogi, the things that he gets excited by, are not things that the yogi takes pleasure in. And when the consciousness of the yogi is awakened, the bhogi is fast asleep. Like for most partygoers, I was told that they would come home at 6 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning. That's when the devotees wake up. Or college students are like that. When I first met a couple of college students and they were becoming interested in Krishna consciousness, one of the best help you can provide a college student is to give them a wake-up call. So they will wake up to chant their rounds. So I gave the college student a service to wake me up, because they would be getting into bed about 3 o'clock. So the service was to call me to wake me up at that time. Just for the humor of it, that hey, when you're already getting ready to sleep, that's the time that I will be waking up. And today, the same very same person wakes up at the completely diametrically opposite time that they would actually be going to sleep at. And they can see the transformation of consciousness in themselves. So the activities may remain the same or similar, not the same, similar. Eating, working, doing different activities. But the consciousness is completely different. So what's the important lesson is we may be doing activities, we may be doing many activities. What makes the activity or what makes the experience transcendental or not depends on where our consciousness is in those activities. Maybe any activity, even devotional activity or activity within the devotional realm. But it is only transcendental when the consciousness is associated with Krishna, when the mind is connected to Krishna, when one is aware that this is for Krishna's pleasure. Only that will make the activity genuinely or the experience genuinely transcendental. Otherwise, it's a lot of activity within the agyata sukruti category. We get benefit, definitely. Instead of, let's say, cleaning the floor. There's quite a bit of difference in cleaning the temple room floor versus cleaning, let's say, McDonald's floor. While there is difference and there is different benefit, well, I don't know what benefit is in cleaning McDonald's floor, but there's definitely benefit cleaning temple floor. But when we are aware and conscious that this is for Krishna, then it is transcendental activity. Unknowingly also we may do it, we may get benefit out of it, sure. But that's agyata. Our duty or call to action is to perform jnata bhakti, or awake, or conscious devotional service. And as long as we are conscious, or like Prabhupada would say, as long as we are Krishna conscious, then the opportunity for becoming bewildered again is not existent. Now for us, for most of us, we cannot say that we are completely free of illusion. We can say that we are progressing towards complete enlightenment. Just as in a completely dark room, even if we turn on the light, there's a switch called dimmer stat. Right? Dimmer stat means you can control the intensity of light in that lamp. When you first turn it on, the bulb glows very dimly. Even that dim light is sufficient to dispel a majority of the darkness in the room. Correct? Like otherwise we would not know where the chair is, where the table is. We'd probably bump into a table or chair or whatever that's on the floor. But as soon as you turn on the light a little bit, you can distinguish there's a table, there's a chair. You may not distinguish the specific details of, oh, there's a piece of paper here, or the floor is dirty. We may not be able to distinguish that. As the dimmer stat, the intensity of light increases, we begin to see more details, or more specifics of what's what, how things are. So we can safely say that the light's on, and we are in the process of increasing the intensity of enlightenment in our consciousness. So progressively we become aware of things that we were not aware of previously. And we become aware of certain things in greater depth. For example, before we came to Krishna consciousness, hardly any one of us ever thought, I'm proud. In fact, we were encouraged to be proud. And so what's wrong with that? Proud, so what's wrong with that? But once we come to devotional service and we hear the very first thing, Trinada Pi Sunichan, it's like, wow. Then we at least accept, I'm proud, Prabhu, whatever, however we accept it. So we may be aware that pride is not a healthy quality to have. But the intensity of pride that we have, we don't have full understanding of. It's only as we start practicing Krishna consciousness that we figure out, whoa, this is a very deeply ingrained problem. Anger, lust, envy, all of these are very deeply ingrained. And so ingrained that it actually makes us sometimes hopeless. Like, wow, will I ever be able to overcome? And that realization, in one sense, is a good realization. Because it is also true that we cannot overcome these deeply ingrained conditionings. So the process of bhakti is to call out to Krishna to help us. And for Krishna it's very easy to remove all of our lust and anger and envy and pride in a jiffy. And it's done. But that depends on the intensity of our calling out to Krishna and the seriousness that we really want to get rid of it. And Krishna wants to see how serious we are, that we really want to get rid of these qualities. Until then he helps us, but he doesn't fully remove it. So we recognize, oh my gosh, so much anger, so much lust, and all. So that means that the dimmerstat, the intensity of light is growing, and that's we're getting a real look at the stark reality of being conditioned. And that's a nice realization. For most people, for most devotees, anartha nivritti becomes a very fearful state. Actually, it is said that anartha nivritti, if there is actual nivritti, if you're just about figuring out anarthas, then it's not nivritti. It's just that we are, oh, I'm becoming more conscious of my anarthas. That's a fearful condition. But nivritti means removal. And removal only happens to the degree that one is actually depending on Krishna to remove it. As long as one is depending on one's own ability, strength, intelligence, and determination. Oh, determination is a tricky one, but in determination too, that I will get rid of my anger. It doesn't work like that. To the degree that one is becoming dependent on Krishna to remove those things from the heart, to that degree one becomes free of them. Now, depending does not mean, once a week some fervent prayer. That also is nice. But it means on a daily basis that we are conscious of that relationship with Krishna. That is what dependence means. That my survival depends on my relationship with Krishna. So will I do certain things that will hurt this relationship? Then I will not do. What can I do? What activities can I perform by which my relationship with Krishna will enhance? I will do those. This is called dependent. Because we are dependent on the relationship with Krishna. Free of that relationship or devoid of that relationship, we have no hope. We have no hope at all. That is the way to progressively move out of illusion. And if that relationship becomes clouded, then illusion manifests again. So it's proportionate. To whatever degree the intensity of the relationship has weakened, to that degree illusion sets in. To whatever degree our relationship with Krishna is strengthening, to that degree illusion is dissipated. And by the grace of the previous acharyas, by the grace of the spiritual master, we have been set on course for freedom from all illusion. Nashtamoha smitir labdhva. That is the stage that we are all heading towards. Just by coming to shelter of Srila Prabhupada and Prabhupada's followers. That ultimate stage has already been determined and guaranteed. Only thing that separates us from that goal is the time. And it's up to us. One lifetime, two, 20, 10 million, it's up to us. How we want to get to that. The goal is already guaranteed. It's like a post-dated guarantee. It's given. That's for each one of us to determine and decide when we want to encash that check. Signed by Lord Chaitanya, signed by Srila Prabhupada, verified by the spiritual master, in fact handed to us by the Guru, here's your ticket back to Godhead. It's all up to us when we want to show up. You'd like to add anything? Like to say something? Okay, Bhakti Luke, yes, that's something.
Hi, Vishnu Guru. Thank you very much. What is it that determines how long it will take? What pace, the pace at which we will advance? What is it that determines that?
What determines the pace? There are many things. And they're all interconnected. In statistics, we generally have a phrase called interdependence. There are many variables, but they're all interacting with each other. So bhakti is also like that. Many variables are interacting with each other. So you can't say this one thing. You can't say that. But the map that Lord Krishna gives is Yesham Tvantakatam Papam Jananam Punya Karmanam Te Dvandva Mohanir Mukta Bhajante Mam Drudhavrata. The determination to continue comes or is in proportion to the weakening of sinful activities. But we need determination to overcome sinful activities too. So for that, Krishna says, in the 10th chapter, those four verses, that I give the intelligence by which they can come to me. But for that, one has to have this connection, satato yuktanam. And then Krishna says, I, out of compassion, dispel all the darkness from their heart. So if it is all to boil down to one thing, that's where Rupa Goswami gives us in Nectar of Devotion, that the one thing is eagerness. So what determines how eager one is? How eager one is to encash the ticket or check Lord Chaitanya has given. So people have different varying degrees of eagerness. And we also have varying degrees of eagerness. Some days, very eager. Some days, not so eager. Some days, not eager at all. And the next day, very eager. And so what helps us move from one position to another is how hard a slap we get from Maya. If Maya gives us a nice caress and kiss on the cheek, then we say, it's okay. She gives us a slap, then we turn around. We turn around. Or we get some extra special mercy from the devotees of Krishna. Then our eagerness is inspired. But it's the eagerness. And who has jurisdiction over our eagerness? We have. Everything else Krishna takes care. The removal of unwanted things in the heart, the deliverance of mercy, etc. Everything Krishna takes care, and Krishna's devotees take care. All we have is in our department is to be eager. And eagerness is not like Prabhupada says, enthusiasm is not imagined ecstasy. Right? That's the first sentence in Nectar of Instruction when he talks about enthusiasm. It's not imagined ecstasy. It's practical activity. It's demonstrated by practical activity. That's how we show eager Krishna, our eagerness. That's what determines.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Sure. Have you noticed that sometimes it's the newcomers who are more eager than those who are already here? No? You've not experienced like that? When we first came to Krishna consciousness, the first one round that we used to chant had so much more intensities, sometimes we've noticed, than the 16 that we put out every day. Yeah. One round when we heard something, or when the special event we came to, a new festival, a Rath Yatra, the services that the newcomer will do, it is like so much enthusiasm. So why is it that a person who's been on the path of bhakti sometimes seems like they're less eager? One difference is, for the newcomer, the eagerness is the sense of newness. And for some, the mind is such that when the new thing is repeated, it becomes an old thing. And so it's possible that the enthusiasm can drop. And so it's said that to keep that enthusiasm ever fresh, one has to cultivate that spiritual conception. Only then enthusiasm will remain ever fresh. We don't see that in Prabhupada. We don't see that in some of Prabhupada's followers. Their enthusiasm is ever fresh. Conception is spiritual.
How can one be eager and also patient?
Eagerness is our department. Anything that comes from that is Krishna's department. We have no control over mercy. So to be patient, the first lesson to learn is that Krishna is fully independent. Abhigya, Swarat. Both are important. Abhigya, Krishna is fully cognizant of everything, directly and indirectly. So impatience sometimes is we wonder if Krishna is really listening, is he really aware, or devotees are there. Krishna is fully aware, directly and indirectly, of everything and everyone. And Swarat, fully independent. So mercy is his department, not ours. Just because we are eager, it doesn't mean that Krishna has to roll out the red carpet for us. He does, but it's not necessary. As long as the conception is not clear that Krishna is a person, is fully independent, and he can do what he likes, patience will not develop properly. If this is clear, one has to be patient anyway, it's not in my hands. Impatience comes from this tendency to control, tendency to, as Prabhupada says, lord it over. But it's not in our hands. Mercy is not in our hands. Nothing in this world works because we're doing something. I have some ability. I can lift a book. I can push this table. So I've been given something, but I'm not the ultimate controller. So patience is that Krishna, mercy comes from Krishna, it comes at his will, when he likes. So we are supposed to be asha bandha, bound by hope. Hopeless, but very hopeful at the same time. When we look at ourselves, we are very hopeless. When we look at Krishna, there is hope. Glenn?
Thank you, Prabhu, for class. Isn't Krishna's mercy, though, whatever Krishna does, I needn't understand it, but isn't it always in my best interest?
Yeah, but it's a relationship. If I don't have a relationship, I will not have that realization that it is in my best interest. That means, when I have an interest separate from Krishna's interest, then my interest tells me how things should be for me to recognize, this is for my benefit. But when our interest is Krishna's interest, when our interest is Krishna, that we care for this relationship because he's very loving and kind, whatever, however we see that, then whatever happens, one can say, this is in my best interest. But without a relationship, you cannot see. If a child doesn't love the parent, the child will never acknowledge that whatever the parent is doing is for their benefit. Because no relationship, or a weak relationship. So philosophically, it's true. Whatever Krishna does is for the benefit of all living entities. But where's the realization? The realization comes from relationship. Any final question? Himanshu?
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. You're explaining how bhakti is an inside-out process.
Yes.
Or an outside-in.
Yes.
One of the things that I always struggle with sometimes is I always get a million ideas.
You always have a million ideas? Oh, yes, you do. Speak in the mic, please. We turn the speak. No, we speak. Turn it away.
So, obviously, just, you know, new ideas coming from the inside doesn't always mean like some outpouring of devotion, right? It could just be my conditioned nature that this is how I operate. So how do we, for our own selves, differentiate between, okay, what's coming from the inside is not my conditioned nature, but is actually something devotional versus, you know what I'm saying? How do we know for ourselves where what's my, you know what I'm saying? What's coming from the inside?
Well, coming from the mind doesn't mean coming from inside. Mind is extraneous to the soul, so it is still coming from outside. Coming from the heart means from the soul, and it's difficult to distinguish. So there are certain symptoms by which we can distinguish. One symptom is that by default we just accept that it's perhaps mixed. Rather than say, this is Krishna's inspiration. Krishna is telling me to do this. That's presumptuous. Another way is to verify it or take it to the spiritual master or the senior devotee and see how they see the same thing. Another would be, while there may be a genuine, let's say, an idea, there is also a sense of ownership associated with that idea sometimes. The ownership is, it's my idea, it must happen. And if it doesn't happen, then my enthusiasm takes a dip. You can say that that's an indicator that maybe it's an extraneous. Our enthusiasm shouldn't dip. Enthusiasm is connected with conception. When conceptions become material, enthusiasm dips. When conceptions remain spiritual, enthusiasm remains, all right, grows. So an idea, whether it came from Krishna's inspiration or whatever, mind or however, if there is ownership to it, meaning it's my idea, it must be done, then it gets entangled with other things in it. Yeah? So, another aspect is we can say that the inspiration came from Krishna, depending on how much we're feeling connected to Krishna, how much it is genuinely for Krishna's pleasure. That's a tricky area, because we don't know how much we're thinking of Krishna's pleasure, how much it is genuinely for Krishna's pleasure. It may make us feel good. That's different. Some things may give Krishna a lot of pleasure, but we may not feel good about it. Like being humble, being tolerant, being gentle in our speech, or something. It may not be nice for us, but it may be very pleasing to Krishna. Does that answer your question? Okay. Okay, it's 8:30. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Gaura Premananda.